Hello, and welcome to the 2010s. I'm your host, Nathan Stevens, and today we have on a very special guest, William Ryan Fritch. Fritch has expanded his world of ambient, found sound, chamber over the last 15 years into a world that often crosses paths with film and cinema. Today we talked about his score, Polarity, which is based on the trials and tribulations of northern Inuit tribes in Canada and Alaska dealing with the fallout of climate change. We talked with him about how how the ever-looming specter of climate change has shaped and crafted this immaculate piece of work here on the 2010s.
The first thing I was wondering about is the idea of making kind of political or ecologic messages through instrumental or ambient music. Obviously, people like Ben Frost have done this in the past, but I've always found that it's kind of a tricky tightrope to do because sometimes you're relying a little bit on the press release or the PR. But for you, it feels like there is some anger going through these songs like Muskox and Blistering Wind in particular. How did you try to channel that messaging through music that does not necessarily have a lyrical narrative component?
It's an amazing question, and I would say because the lion's share of my creative energy over the last 15 years, even though I've put out a lot of recorded non-commissioned music, the majority of the impetus of what drives me to experiment with different processes of making sound, composition in general, is through multimedia composing for films and a huge amount of the films that I've worked on have really dealt with some really, really heavy ecological and socio-political and humanitarian crises that they would be in, they could be very microcosmic of like the scale of the story, but seeing the web of just how overwhelmingly the global South indigenous communities around the world are bearing the brunt of man-made climate change and just the ever quickening and tightening spiral or corkscrew of this ecological change is impacting these more vulnerable communities, it inevitably, I mean, it's just like, it's hard to not feel fucking angry. And a film that I worked on that was a huge impetus to making this kind of trilogy of albums in the first place was a film called New Talk that was made by Michael Kirby Smith and Andrew Burton last year. And I mean, this is a longitudinal true commitment that these filmmakers made to want to understand, but over the course of a piece, it's you're like working on a more seismic clock, and then sometimes it's these very fast undulations, and it's you're in the eye of an actual ecological event. So it's like, yeah, a press release, it's just this like, you can dance around the abstractions and the concept, but it's like to actually have something that it hits you in the spleen of like it feels like it's physically doing something to you that it's palpable. It like the concepts aren't just words. It's like it's palpable when you hear the music in your headphones, and that's what I was hoping to do. And that was definitely more so than any particular like arrangement or composition. It was like find the little mitochondria, find this kind of exchange of energy that it feels, it has that anger, that danger, that instability that is like fertile for the concept of the album, and write from that place and let that drive the compositions as a whole. I probably danced way the fuck around your question and didn't actually.
No, you're good. I was going to say, this is obviously ambient music going all the way back to Eno, has moments where it is supposed to go from deeply comforting, welcoming to concussive and disquieting. And it's interesting to me when you're talking about music that is not necessarily completely based off of, is this major or minor? Does this work within whatever mode we're doing, and instead relies more on drones and percussion? You are tapping into different things in terms of how do you make your audience uncomfortable, because that is the narrative purpose of this. I'm thinking of the song Swelter has all these rattling sounds in it, and Muskox has the most obvious percussion on it as well. For those sorts of motions, I mean, what's in your head when you're like, I want to make people feel uncomfortable with this music, but it's for a reason.
I mean, it's uncomfortable. I'm really not even thinking of it like sociologically like that. It's just like, I'm imagining a physiological response of like, how do I make this with the tools that I have at my disposal? And so for like Swelter, the idea that I had was just like that, okay, you're seeing temperatures in the Arctic of like 100, you know, they were finding like snakes and all kinds of insects up in this area that could not previously live up in this region of Alaska because of climate change. And so thinking of this unfamiliar ecosystem eventually emerging in these new marshlands that were, I was like, okay, what makes me think of hearing cicadas, but it's not like this comforting sound. It's more like it's an infestation, and it's this like very strange clarion call that signals that things may not go back to the kind of familiar sonic space of what defined your childhood home or what you were, the way that you grew up. And so I cut all of these different lengths of PVC pipe, you know, put really kind of close cluster, you know, like would tap them, tune them, clip the different pieces of PVC pipe. And I bought 25 solenoids, which are like, you know, like triggers that if you send like an electric impulse for it will pop in and out, and that's kind of just like a push pull lever, and it can be sent control voltage like from a synthesizer to automate this push pull mechanism. So I had all of these and just laid them all across my studio. And, you know, came up with these different sequences that the solenoids would activate on the PVC pipe. Like, you know, and mic'd in the room, hung some a little stereo mic from the top of my barn. And it really did. It just was like, it felt unsettling, like the plastic quality of it. It made the resonances like very, like a little bit unpleasing in a way, because there's so many ways to get this like super high frequency stuff that it sounds like bird call, you know, like friction, you know, high partials when you bow a piece of metal, like lots of things can sound like that. But to have it from this kind of petrol based, you know, plastic source where it's just not an inherently pretty sounding resonance, was pretty satisfying. And then for Muskox, this idea of just this lost relationship with the past of that, like these ancestral hunting grounds are going to kind of be no more, of how do you essentially make these kind of synthesized drums feel like fleshy and tactile and alive and play the way that if you were on a taiko drum or whatever. And I used a bunch of like transducers, got a couple concert bass and would run some 808 signals through these transducers. And that was like the, because you get this driving impulse sent through the drum, but it also has a rebound. Because the drum, and especially depending on how you tune the drum head. And so using that as to kind of determine my primary pulses. And then, of course, adding some elements of organic or organic playing, you know, integrated into it to make that, that to make that sound. But it, yeah, it just, it felt like you were mingling with a real physical thing, and then also just what might have to just be the approximation of it. Like, there will still be the hunting, but what is it done by? It's like you have to snowmobile to these different regions, and what kind of life do these, you know, what migration patterns do these animals have to take? Not to get too fucking specific, but yeah, you know, a lot of like forethought before I start recording, and a lot of afterthought after I hear the sounds of like, do I actually like this? But when it, once the idea of how to make a sound that I find pleasing, it really is just go.
Yeah.
And it's like, am I interested in this? Does this feel inspiring to play with these sounds? More so than that, like, oh, you know, I really should have this go another bar. That will serve the narrative better. I was more interested in really putting a lot of thought into what was going to be the first sound and the first impulse that makes something. And if that feels true, then, you know, you just have to trust and rely on more kind of intuitive processes.
It feels like there's a literal, massively physical component to when you're composing and making music. You're talking about the solenoids, the PVC pipe. I know you use contact mics. You want to see and feel the vibration of these things. What is that? For making music that very often, I think in pop culture, we think of making music on a computer, you are doing a lot of physical work alongside this. Is that partially because of the sounds it outputs, or because you want to feel closer to what you are making?
I mean, there are so many. It's just more, it's like my more in line with my competencies and what like I came to composing music and like, you know, feeling like I can actually call myself a composer or whatever through a very tactile, you know, hands-on approach. Like I loved making sound and I loved playing instruments, and that was what made me, you know, get into music in the first place, and very specifically strings and percussion, where I could feel in so many ways the sound vibrating back through me. And that really being an element of determining my sense of dynamics and so when I, you know, you get to having to write more music for media or more, like, you just realize, like, oh shit, well, it's like so many of these just unbelievable composers, it's like the mother tongue for everything is they just are really savvy writing at a piano. They're really great with MIDI. They're really fantastic producers and know how to use libraries and this ability to make to oftentimes with really, you know, minimal streamlined setups, make a huge range of sound. And I kind of goldfished in a way of like, I've become a hoarder of finding acoustic sounds and resonances that I love. I didn't have a MIDI keyboard until 2019.
Okay.
So it was like, if I was playing a synth or whatever. It's just because it was like, you know, I'd found you know, like a Juno was too expensive, so it was like, you know, I had gotten like a JX3P like when I was in college, when they weren't as, and I was like, oh my gosh, it's so amazing having, you know, a synth, because I love these sounds, but I'm just not a computer person. It's just, it's really I've had to become one for mixing to film, but it's still like I'm so much slower and so much less competent in that arena than most professional composers. But if I hear a sound that either a sound designer or Foley artist, something from the world of a film, I because I've played so many instruments in my life and spent so much time like recording physical sound, I've gotten really adept at reverse engineering sounds that I like in the natural world and finding ways to mimic them or to to borrow some kind of characteristic of those sounds from an instrument. And if I can't make it with some, I have at least enough understanding of building things that I can make something that will make that sound. So a really like wildly inefficient I'm just like kind of a wildly inefficient person that works really hard. You know, it's like, I mean, I've got three films at South by Southwest coming up, and it's like, you know, so two of the films were they're filmmakers I've worked with, and they know a little bit how unhinged I can be, and so they give me this huge runway of making all this music really before the picture is locked. So it's like there's a lot of investment in what are like these kind of thematic, textural, sonic, rhythmic elements to it, like way ahead of time. And so the editors are really familiar with, or like they've kind of become accustomed to having this musical language established early. But I'm working on this one documentary about Thomas Kincaid, who, you know, like the painter of light, you know, and it's such a fucking great film. I mean, but the people that are making it, oh man, they're so on top of their shit. They're so professional. They have a huge team. And it's like, you know, 60 cues. And I've done stuff on that scale several times, but it's like, you know, what we were talking about, a lot going on in my life, and the stuff that feels like it feeds my mind and soul is these experiments right now and getting kind of core of what I really love about music. So, but just write, I'm like having to write all of this orchestral, like really like, you know, fanciful kind of orchestral music. But I'm doing it by overdubbing, you know, like, oh, you know, I like, all right, I've got to record two tracks of bassoon here, do English horn, oboe. All right, if I want to make it, I only have, you know, I have a euphonium and a French horn, but I need to make this horn section feel legitimate. So it's like, okay, I'm going to take this, I'm going to slow the speed down a fifth, or speed it up a fifth. Record the euphonium again. Now I get a sound that's somewhat like a contrabass tuba, and just build out these orchestrations by myself. And it's so fucking stupid. It's stupid, but it's like, I mean, I'm you know, I really enjoy doing it, but it's like at a certain point, it's like, okay, you know, I've committed to doing this and I love composing. I'm so grateful for the work and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be able to make music for these films. But I'm really like, I'm playing in a world of where I'm competing against architects, people that are so organized. They are so capable of conceiving these larger musical expressions through a piano or through their DAW, you know? And they're architects, they're engineers. They have this right brain, left brain balance that allows them to make really interesting compositional decisions without touching the sound, without it being proximal, without them actually it passing through their own fingers. And on, I mean, you know, I went and got my master's in composition. You know, I have the orchestration chops. But I mean, this is what I've done now for, you know, 15 to 18 years working this way in kind of a, an atomized sort of way that I'm recording instrument by instrument. And even if I bring in other musicians to collaborate, it's often one or two other musicians that I know their peculiarities, their particular musical skill set. And I utilize it the same way that I utilize my own overdubbing, if that makes sense. So I end up having all of this control over how I spatialize, how I manipulate these sounds, and it's great, but it's a time suck. It's like, you know, you compare that to just going, it's like, I've got 4 days at this studio with this amazing orchestra. The person who's playing violin one, they're not playing seven or eight other instruments in this, or whatever, however many. It's like, no, they are like a fucking incredible virtuosic player. And they're playing it, and it's like you have this, like, you know, one take, and it's just like you've got the recording, bang bang, like all of the kind of pre-writing is making the temp mock-ups of it, making the and I just, it's, I'm just not, I'm, I just, I can't keep up, I can't compete with the skills and the confidence of that without me really feeling the sound that it's mine anymore. And that's just being totally honest. I just, like, a lot of what has allowed me to make unique music, unique, or like I would say, I make interesting but uneven, you know, uneven music, like, because I have a lot of ideas, and sometimes it's like, you know, I put maximum amount of intention behind it, and I full well knowing that some things are going to resonate more with other people than others, but I don't feel comfortable just it being that it's like, hey, you know, I've got the style that I write in, man, and like that's my thing, and I'll, you know, I'll change, I'll bring in, I'll record with this producer or this whatever thing, and then that's my next album. It's like, no, it's like I've got to fundamentally develop a new relationship with something physical for this next record, and that's what gives me the impetus to even try it in the first place, because there's so much amazing music in this life, and it's like, what purpose are you putting more music out there if it's not to a certain point fulfilling something within yourself?
Yeah.
And I feel that so very strongly each time I press record, of that I'm hoping to learn something more about myself, in the way that I interact with the physical and emotional world around me.
Paint me a picture of your shed. What's your shed like?
The barn that I work out of?
Yeah.
Okay. it's a 1,000 square foot old pole barn from 1909 that it's like a redwood slat barn, corrugated metal roof, but I had to build a whole structure within a structure. Because it was, you know, kind of left in a little bit of disarray. Did a floating kind of concrete floor. I had to learn so much about construction. I'm not a very practical man. And you know, my father was a citrus farmer, very pragmatic, very, and he just was like very determined to like have me be an educated person, of like, no, like, you don't want to learn how to work on cars. It's like, no, you're gonna go to college, or like, just, you know. And then of course it's like I get to be, you know, a 30 something year old, and I'm just like, no, like, I am so fucking sick of not having the skills to fix things. I'm sick of it. It's ridiculous. And so when I bought my house in 2017, the barn was a huge huge driver for why it was just the right, you know, I was working out of a old chicken barn for almost a decade that I loved, but I mean, so much of what made the sound of my music from 2010 to 2017 was that it was like I was recording all of this music in like an acoustic guitar body. I mean, that's what this chicken barn was. It was huge, long redwood slats that probably couldn't even handle all the weight of the like dumpster dive organs that I salvaged, and just like all these impractical instruments, you know, broken harpsichords. And I was like, I'm gonna get this thing fixed one day, like really playing well. It's like, nope, you're gonna have a shitty, not very good sounding harpsichord that takes up a lot of space. And so it's like, this was a very reverberant sound. There is nothing dead. It's just like you hit a drum and everything in the whole room shakes. And that was what my whole, that was just like, whatever, everything had that sound. It was very bad kind of isolation. So what I wanted with this new barn was I wanted a lot of different reflective places to record within this one structure, so that based on where you had an instrument, it totally changed the character of. So I have a well room where it's like, it's literally my well, the well to the property. And it's a 120 foot metal well. And so I can go in this room, open the well cover, and play in this room and immediately have a crazy echo. And it's just undefeated. If you want to make something that is just like super strange, you know, and I can put the cover over the well at different levels, and it affects just by how intense the echo is. I can put microphones down into the well, suspend them, and capture more of that or less of it. I have a little ISO room that is 150 square foot space, really, really immediate reflectivity. I put the kind of wood floors that I put in is like super bright, really quick, sharp reverb and echo or like response. And I also have it so I can reamp in there. I can run guitar amps. I can run and use that as a different kind of space. And then the main room has a 20 foot ceiling that comes down at a pitch for the backside of the barn. So just within that one room, there's like a loft. I can hang microphones from the ceiling. I can set up, you know, set my drums up in the more resonant open part of the barn. And it just changes. So I wanted that flexibility. And I've, of course, goldfished myself into this space. And it's just, God damn, I have just so many instruments in there right now. I mean, like one, and I'm about to have my, this portative organ. So like a pipe organ that is hand pumped. You know, they're originally like medieval organs and small, you know, like the pipes would be about 3 feet and you could strap it around your neck and be able to have this organ to play like, you know, medieval jigs or whatever. This is going to be like 6 foot pipes, but I'll be able to do vibrato and, you know, bend notes by under pumping it by hand, things instead of having a blower, and also no electrical or resonant frequency from feeding the blowers. It's all hand pumped. And so that's going to take up a bunch of space. So I need to simplify, because I have just, man, I have filled every crevice with, it's like, ooh, I found all this driftwood and it's like a pentatonic scale. How can I not leave with this? I'm going to bring this into the like.
You're playing the driftwood?
Oh yeah, man. Like the driftwood, it's like in, so like all of the things that kind of sound like claves, in Storm, it's all of these different pieces of driftwood that were washed up when we had a major storm here in Northern California. So I had gone to these hundreds and hundreds of, I mean, well, thousands of pieces of driftwood, found the ones that resonated and were worn in a way that it had a really particular sound.
So you use these pieces of driftwood, and that's what made that. And they're just amazing. And it's like, so, you know, most people are like, you know, percussionists, and they've got like a clave. They've got these, you know, LP claves, super a bright, you know, Brazilian rosewood sort of thing, really classic, tight, focused click. And sometimes that's really nice, and it's exactly what works. But I like having every kind of wood. Mm. And the particular, you know, so like I've got pieces of birch, you know, like cutoffs of or, you know, the driftwood, 2x4s, you know, whatever, just like, and those all make different kind of, and also gives you the opportunity of, you know, finding this in between from like idiophones that are pitched like a marimba to non-pitched materials. But it's like, you know, they're more complex overtones and less focused. But it's a wonderful way of making kind of material that has this unspoken dissonance because of the imperfection of the overtones. Mm. So it's like it can be this relatively benign, sweet sort of percussive sound, but there is a little mystery living inside of it. So there is an implied darkness or chaos that when compounded with other things, you know, it's just like you get a different vibe. And I mean, I'm not like expecting any of this. It's just like again, I'm just interested in this, and it's like I'm not doing it to like you know, just be a fucking you know, a peculiar little head basket. It's just like, I just like the sound, and it's something that I want to try, and then I end up having a junkyard menagerie instead of like a cool Instagram looking studio. But it's okay. I love sounds, and if it was a free world and I didn't need to you know, put kibble in the dog food bowl and you know, take care of my kids, I would probably spend most of my time just cultivating different sounds and instruments. And, you know, I was like, God, I want to make it just an album of just like each like material I can think of just like, what can I make with just springs and explore, just like give myself a sabbatical and look at all the different kinds of tension springs and everything. And it's just like, that's it. I'm just going to make music with this particular part and find a language of playing these things, or, you know, whatever, just out of curiosity. Cause then it's like, you have that knowledge forever. You yeah. find these little, like it's a resplendent gift finding these little hidden sounds inside of things, because then it just expands what your orchestrational possibilities are, you know. And I'm sure for each thing I gain with that, I become a shittier fucking guitarist, which is probably a better thing for the world. the more I forget about the instruments that were once my specialty, probably the better.
You big Matmos guy?
You know what? Wait, they did the washing machine album?
Yeah, I was just thinking of the classic washing machine albums. Man. Yeah.
Yeah, fuck, those guys are so smart, man. I just like, and they're writer, like just really great writers too. I've read some just different, I forget if it's like a Substack that one of the guys had, but I don't know. Really like on another continuum of intelligence and than I am on, you know. I am a lowly hedonist. I have so much respect, because they actually make that stuff and people want to actually shake their asses to some of it too. So yeah. It's like so they're making it work on multiple levels, which I respect very deeply.
You were saying during Storm, you were talking about this kind of with your driftwood claves of this implied darkness and chaos. I wanted to talk about where there's no implied, it just is darkness and chaos on what I think is the centerpiece of the record and the song that I think really took me in, which was Blistering Wind. I wanted to ask about that because not only is it the longest, but we had talked earlier about how do you create anger within something that does not have a lyrical centerpiece to it and may not be constructed by the bounds of traditional chords and keys. So could you kind of take me through the anger of that song as and how you like made it, stretched it out to this nearly 8 minute long song?
So I'd really fallen in love with the contrabass clarinet, one of my favorite instruments, just period. I love how there's certain notes you play on it, no matter how well it's made, there's going to be keys that rattle on it. Just, it's like the resonance is too much for the instrument, and you get this, like, it's the because there's like has to be this certain springiness to be able to close a valve. And when you play this low E flat on it, there's nothing that can happen except that you get this sympathetic rattle. And then so it brought me down the path of what are all the other little rattly sounds I can get from this instrument? And what notes trigger the most interesting sympathetic rattles? And when I layer them on top of each other on a really long ass loop that I made from, let's say I had two tape machines, that one is kind of a hi-fi one. I've got this Atari that I actually calibrate and demagnetize the heads and, you know, whatever. It's just like, it's a machine that is important. Actually, it was the machine that Papa Roach recorded their first album on.
Where do you find this stuff?
This was Craigslist 2012 in Vallejo, where I guess one of the band members was from Vallejo. It just was like, I mean, I didn't know this when I went to go buy it, and it was like, oh yeah, you know, so like we recorded the studios where Papa Roach, and I was like, oh fuck, like what kind of spirit is living inside this machine, because that song is like, and I was like, oh, this is a really reasonable price for this machine, and it's huge and it's bulky and it's a little unwieldy and it needs some work. And also
plays Last Resort sometimes in Midnight.
Yeah, exactly. And Papa Roach, just like, they put all of their angsty hair gel man juice, you know, all over it. So, all right. So this one, back to Blistering Winds. So made a kind of extended loop, ran a stretched it. I forget how long I cut the tape, but it would be kind of the equivalent of like a 50 second run that I felt like I could cycle through these different notes on the contrabass clarinet, and it was a good length that allowed me enough unpredictability that it could roll over and you would lose the sense of where the one and on the pattern was. So did this, and it was clean. Like, it was like a really super tight cut on the block. The loop was a clean loop, and recorded that one layer. And that's, you'll hear in the beginning of the piece of the music, lots of breath. So I'm like blowing in, but I'm doing really loose embouchure, or which is like, you know, how tight of a seal you make against the reed. Lots of air getting through. So you have this layer of hiss going over and over, just like little bits of spittle and everything. So it becomes this hiss that is like, it's a clean layer. And I was like, oh, that's really kind of interesting. And it's starting to feel like inherent in this is this condescension, this 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 real angst in the way that the sound's speaking to me. So then I became interested in doing a pass of it where I actually take a little bit of, as it's going through, I put like a little bit of sandpaper across this run of tape, removing some of the magnetic stripping, going over it. So then there's more vacuums of space, white and pink noise start emerging in place of more clear tonal stuff. Did it a little more, did a little more, wearing this perfectly, you know, okay sounding loop down each run. And, you know, it's like, you know, the romantic like version of it is like what Baczynski did of like something actually happens.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, and like that's super romantic and beautiful. This is like totally me intentionally fucking up perfectly good, expensive 1-inch magnetic tape in order to create these layered imperfections and spots of where noises are just being kind of canceled out against one another, and then running them in unison, you know, so it creates a lot of instability. And it just, the relationship of it, it just like it kept shifting and shifting and shifting. And then I was like, okay, there's something missing in this piece. I'm missing some kind of percussive, like irregular marker of time. And so I ended up putting a couple contact mics on the contrabass clarinet down near where the bottom pads are. There's a lot of percussionists. There are a lot of saxophonists and people that do kind of similar things. But then I made a loop of just me kind of blowing air and then, you know, thumping these pads down. So you're still hearing the click, the breath, the spittle, all of that stuff. But and then slowing the speed down so that the loop would had like a different white noise effect. So like I forget what point in the song, but you start to hear this different white noise compounding over the top of it, and it like it's a slow kind of fade in, but eventually the ear space is changing a little bit, and you hear these like occasional rhythmic hits, and that's that loop being engaged over the top of it. I don't know. It was a really different, piece. The guy who runs my record label, Ryan Keene, just like the sweetest, most amazing guy. I mean, we've been working together now for 12 years, and there's no way I would release records the way that I have without him. You know, he's such an encouraging, well, like I'll just send him stuff that I do that I probably would never release, or just like, it's just like, oh, that's interesting. I'll use something of that, or I'll use an idea from that for film or another album or whatever. You know, it's like a lot of, and I really thought of this tape loop piece as something that is like, that's a really cool little experiment. And that actually sounds really nice, selectively damaging elements of the tape. And because it's like it would be even more powerful if it was like a 2-inch, you know, I had a 2-inch tape and I could actually really kind of see the striations in it and see where different elements of it are. But like, it's still, it was a good enough recording that you do these things and you actually hear a material change to the rhythm of how the imperfections are hitting. And so he heard it and he was like, this is the best, this is my favorite piece on the album. I was like, no, give me a fucking break, dude. This is just a drone. Like, you know, it's like, whatever. It's just like, and he's like, no, this has to be like, this is the centerpiece of what this album is. And so it was an afterthought for me initially. I mean, I put a lot of like intention into making it, but my relationship with it, as me, like, actually liking it or thinking about putting it out, was totally, I had to be coaxed.
You had said a pink noise earlier. Can you explain that?
Distinction, and I'm sure there'll be like someone who's like a real, you know, a more intelligent audiophile. My understanding of it and the way that I used it in that context is that there is white noise is like this. It is static, and it is the pink noise has little particulates of audio signal, of things that actually correlate to the input source, therefore coloring it. And so I didn't want there just to be like hiss, you know, I wanted there to be like, something damaged is trying to speak through it. So it's like, it's noise that I'm like choking. I'm like, I'm kind of choking off.
Yeah.
And so that, became an interesting texture where it's like when I want it to feel, when I wanted it to feel like it's howling, it's like, this is like, it's actually peeling away. Like your skin is so dry and irritated from this wind. It's like, it's like a razor blade kind of going over a sunburn, you know, like you're shaving and you have just like terribly sunburned cheek or something like that. And, the way that I was like doing it, it was just like, I really make this kind of barren part on that I had like shaved down on the tape stuff, play only that track off of the head.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be like, okay, tracks 1 and 2, it's the furthest to the left of the tape, really like get those sounding fucked up. And I only record outputs 1 and 2, and it's like, it's noisy, but it's trying to say something and the information is just not there.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you for the clarification. No, I was legitimately curious. That's a cool thing. I just had one last question, which was about kind of on a more hopeful note after all the other stuff that, you know,
talks about. I'm a pretty positive person. I mean, I have to be that way. I have to have a lot of love because, man, it really is just, it's very upsetting to just constantly feel kind of powerless for the genuine lack of empathy and care and desire for equanimity that there is in the world. And it's just like, but man, you gotta wake up the next day and try.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing of like part of the, you know, not just the message behind the album and the film and all of these things is also that 50% of the proceeds from this album go to healthy Alaskan natives. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you got involved with that, what they do, and maybe, you know, spread a little bit of awareness to folks who may not be as aware of some of the issues that those folks face.
Well, I mean, there's so many... so many issues that you know, like Newtok is just the first of many villages, and that could be facing similar realities very, very soon. And you know, this organization, they have you know, when COVID really hit a lot of the elders of these areas very hard. And, you know, to be able to have proper support and care for you know, the vulnerable elders in these communities, it was just like this organization just, man, they stepped up in a huge way when there was a massive storm that hit, you know, those of Newtok that had not been able to leave yet. It was just a fucking devastating, man. And it's just like salt in the wounds. And, you know, really credit to Andrew and Michael, who did New Talk of that they were, you know, really talking with people in the community of like what is actually getting help to the people there. What are organizations that are really on the ground trying? And so I have just, you know, I have a lot of confidence that the intention is really good. And, you know, there's huge, you know, huge organizations that have so much, you know, like have lobbies and can really do more seismic, but like, because of how personal the music in this album was informed by just the tremendous, I mean, you know, I'm only like worked on this film is just but a tiny little wedge and moment of the rich, incredible story of the people of New Talk. But even in that tiny little bit, what it did for my feeling of what culture and home really means, and the power of the enduring of their language, of their traditions, in spite of having it forced upon them, this relocation. It just I felt completely unworthy of even having anything to touch this because it's so powerful, that resilience. So, you know, I mean, this is like, I don't know. I hope that every little bit counts, but really it's just, I would do a fuck of a lot because I just, these people are amazing. And everyone that I met from the village of New Talk, and so grateful that the people who made the film allowed me to really kind of feel like part of this team that was on the ground, even though it's like, you know, like whatever, man, I am in my barn, in this kind of hermetic life, you working on a lot of films that have, that try to shine a light on major and really difficult things that show a lot of vulnerability and take a lot of trust for the film's subjects to allow a journalist to be able to try and shepherd this part of their story and share it. And it's a tremendous amount of trust, and it could be so easily manipulated, and both the filmmakers that really feel this sense of responsibility to do so dutifully, responsibly, and lovingly, I have so much respect. And then the people that open their hearts to sharing and to showing that their truth for the hope that it could make lives for others better. It's just amazing. And it is so inspiring. And that organization is doing, it felt like the most direct way to be involved and to have some sort of actual real meaning to putting this music out, aside from it just being my own kind of curiosity.